anything preliminary? Questions? Okay, at the end of class yesterday, we sort of did a rapid flyover of the cases on assumption of risk. And again, I want to emphasize the way in which this term can be used in a variety of confusing ways. It can mean different things, and the courts have struggled with it. The other phenomenon, which is explained in more detail in those articles that I made available to you, is the whole way in which the shift from a bar on contributory negligence to a comparative fault regime has resulted in a fair amount of confusion as to how that applies to assumption of risk. Of course, before the advent of comparative negligence, it really didn't matter whether you classified something as assumption of risk on the one hand or contributory negligence on the other. If either doctrine applied, the plaintiff's claim would be barred. But once you have this shift from a contributory negligence bar to a rule in which the plaintiff's negligence only reduces the plaintiff's recovery but doesn't bar it, well, then it makes a big difference whether you're applying a doctrine like assumption of risk, which says, in effect, what would otherwise be negligent is no longer negligent, or the plaintiff somehow consented to or agreed to what the defendant was doing. So again, my overall suggestion in these cases is to try to figure out exactly what might be meant by this concept of assumption of risk. If the defendant says, I'm not liable because the plaintiff assumed the risk, in what sense should we take that claim? And again, the classification scheme that I gave you was, there is a variety of assumption of risk sitting in an unscreened baseball seat in which it's appropriate to say the plaintiff's recovery isn't just reduced, the plaintiff doesn't have a claim. If, in fact, the defendant has simply delivered what the plaintiff wanted, now, in retrospect, the plaintiff may have changed their mind, or the plaintiff may say, I, unlike other baseball patrons, didn't really want an unscreened seat. But if, nonetheless, the defendant has done nothing more than deliver what plaintiffs or participants in this activity wanted, then really the plaintiff has no ground for complaint. The second kind of assumption of risk, where you can, I think, be reasonably confident of the outcome, are those cases in which, although you could say the plaintiff assumed a risk, the plaintiff voluntarily got in a car with an intoxicated driver, knowing that the driver was impaired, recognizing the risk that this entailed. You may, in fact, have a conversation in which these things are established, you know, where the passenger says to the driver, gee, you don't look like you're in any shape to drive. Knowledge of the risk. Driver says, well, if you want, you can get a ride from somebody else. Plaintiff says, all right, I'll go with you. Voluntary assumption of a known risk, but when we stand back and look at it, what we're really saying there is not that the plaintiff bargained for some kind of different way of getting home, but rather that the plaintiff was guilty of contributory negligence. So again, in those cases in which the label doesn't really get us anything different from an ordinary kind of contributory negligence case, then we treat it just like contributory negligence. But then there are a third set of cases, and that's the one reflected by the cheerleader case. true, the defendant didn't simply give the plaintiff what she wanted. If the defendant had simply said, you know, there's AstroTurf out there in Martin Stadium, you can stand on other people's shoulders, but there's a risk you're going to fall down and hurt yourself, the timorous may stay at home. If that's all the defendant did, there would be no ground for liability. But the defendant didn't just do that. The defendant negligently provided inadequate facilities in which to practice, didn't provide the coach that they knew or should have known was necessary to make this reasonably safe. But at the same time, the court recognizes, well, yeah, but the plaintiff chose to participate in an activity she knew was dangerous. In some sense, she did assume the risk. Now, this is the area where, in my experience, or in my observation, the courts are most likely to have problems. On the one hand, you can have the defendant argue successfully that since the plaintiff voluntarily engaged in an activity that was risky, the plaintiff's claim should be barred altogether. Or you can have cases in which the court says, well, the plaintiff assumed a risk, but not the risk of this negligent feature, and therefore assumption risk doesn't cover this case, and the plaintiff gets a full recovery. I think from a policy standpoint, it's actually better to do what the court did in Kirk versus Washington State, which is to allow both principals to have their respective role, to allow the jury to assign some share of the responsibility to the defendant for the defendant's negligence, but at the same time allow the defendant to offset that by the inherent risk of the activity. This, for example, is what I think should have been done in a case actually brought against my employer, Gonzaga University. A student at Gonzaga was enrolled in a scuba diving course, and the first part of the course is taught in the swimming pool across the street, where they learn how to, you know, use the equipment and, you know, how to get the weights properly adjusted and this, that, and the other thing. After they've learned all this in the safety of the pool, the sort of crowning moment of this class is they go over to Lake Coeur d'Alene and actually dive down into the lake. And while they were doing this at one of the classes, they got down about, I don't know, 80 or 100 feet, something like that, and the student suddenly thought there was something wrong with the air that he was getting. And he also, down lower in the lake, it's harder and harder to see, lost track of his instructor, who had other students. The instructor happened to be Jim West, Senator Jim West, who was an adjunct instructor for the university. This student panicked and headed for the surface. And unfortunately, one of the consequences of doing that is that you get an air bubble that migrates to your brain and causes an embolism, and the student died. Parents sued the university, arguing that they're like Kirk versus Washington State, no supervision, at least negligent supervision, and negligent training, in effect, negligent assessment of the student's ability to do this. The university responded by saying, but he signed a release that said, I understand this is a risky thing, and I release the university from any liability for for any injury. What should be the result there? If that case is like Kirk versus Washington State, the jury should have determined, first of all, was the university negligent? Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Maybe the instruction was just fine. Maybe the student simply didn't follow the instructions This is not something that reasonable care would have prevented. But if they found that that was that there was negligence, according to Kirk versus Washington State, you would have had an allocation of some fault to the university and an allocation of how much this was the inherent risk of scuba diving, which the plaintiff freely, or the decedent freely chose. What did the court do? Barred the claim. Found that by signing the release, the plaintiff gave up any right except in cases of gross negligence. Well, that wasn't the rule they applied in Kirk versus Washington State, at least not according to my lights. But that's what Division III of the Court of Appeals said. Similarly, there was a case, I happened to get involved in it, where a lady bought some new skis, had her old ski bindings, wanted her old bindings put on her new skis, took it down to Wintersport. Wintersport took the order, called her up, said her skis were ready. She comes in to pick up her skis. They hand her a ticket that essentially, you know, says, well, you know, here, sign this essentially to say you've gotten your skis. But, oh, by the way, it says, I understand that, you know, Wintersport's not responsible for any injury I may suffer using these skis. She signs it, goes off skiing, the first time she's, or, you know, one of the first times she's going down the hill, she misses a turn and loses her balance and falls. And instead of releasing, as ski bindings are supposed to do, the ski stayed attached to her foot and wrenched her knee. And when the ski patrol came to try to help her out, they couldn't even get the ski bindings to release until they started whacking it with their equipment. So, allegedly, something's wrong with the ski binding, negligently adjusted. But the defendant says, look here at this release you signed. You said we're not liable for our negligence. Now, to me, the proper result would be to say this is just like Kirk versus Washington State. Risky activity combined with negligence on the part of the defendant, assuming we can prove it. Court said, no, barred. Unless you can prove gross negligence, according to this Gonzaga University case, Boys versus West, you have no claim. Now, again, I think there's a conflict here between the principle that's announced here and the rulings that the court do elsewhere. And my reason for bringing that to your attention is simply to say, in these areas where you're balancing the question of what did the plaintiff really bargain for, what, as a matter of public policy, should we, you know, how far should we allow ski resorts and other places to essentially displace the risk? Now, how much do we expect of ski resorts in terms of marking boundaries? I'll give you another example. This one came out better as far as I was concerned. A guy goes up on a ski lift. He's coming down, I think it was over at Crystal Mountain or someplace like that. Going down the slope, loses his balance, realizes he needs to find a landing zone, sees this snowbank off to the side, and figures, well, that'll, you know, cushion my fall instead of being on this, you know, packed powder underfoot. So he heads over there and sort of crashes into this mound of snow. Unfortunately, beneath this mound of snow was a concrete was a snow fence with a steel post encased in concrete. And, of course, between his padding and, you know, he didn't get too badly hurt, but he got hurt. And the question is, was the ski resort negligent in creating this thing that looked like a safe place to land but really wasn't? And the court said, well, yeah, he assumed the risk of, you know, you fall down and go boom. If he'd fallen down on the packed powder, he'd, you know, been avoiding some little kid who was zooming in and out. That's part of the risk of skiing, but he didn't assume the risk of the negligently camouflaged concrete or steel post encased in concrete. Now that to me would be the right way to do it, and again, these are different cases coming out of different, you know, divisions of one, theoretically, one consistent jurisdiction. So again, my advice to you on assumption of risk is simply see what you can make of the facts, recognize that the defendant is going to be very anxious to get a result like the one in Boyce versus West or in by Ski Bindings case where they're out of it completely. But on the other hand, the plaintiff's going to argue for some sort of comparative rule as was done in Kirk versus Washington State. Questions about assumption of risk before we... Mr. Jones.
In the Alston and Blythe case,
yeah.
I see that there's four facets to the assumption of risk. Did you sort of condense a couple of them? Or?
Yeah, I kind of do my own thing with that. You know, the four categories actually turn into six when you have express, an implied, primary, secondary, reasonable, unreasonable. You can wind up with all these different sort of permutations and combinations, and it would be one thing if by knowing the classification you could figure out what happened, but you can't. So for example, express assumption of risk is where you actually sign a piece of paper, as opposed to implied assumption of risk, which would be like my showing up at the basketball court at Coeur d'Alene Park on an afternoon and join in the game of, you know, pick up basketball, knowing that this is the way the game is played. But express assumption of risk doesn't necessarily bar the claim. That was the other thing I was frustrated by in my Ski Bindings case. When I pointed out to the Court of Appeals that there was a previous case, in fact, it's one mentioned in Kirk versus Washington State, Shorter versus Drury, where the plaintiff was, actually the decedent again, was a Jehovah's Witness who didn't want a blood transfusion. She goes into surgery, signs a, you know, release that says, in effect, I don't want a blood transfusion and I'm aware of the consequences of not getting a blood transfusion, but I don't want it anyway. The doctor negligently causes her to bleed, lacerates her in the course of the surgery, and she bleeds to death. Does the court look at that signed express assumption of risk and say, yeah, but, you know, you asked for it, you got it? No, the court said, we're going to consider that a form of fault. Compare it to, they did one of these comparative percentage offset deals. So, again, depending upon how the court views the case, these different categories may be used either to, on a comparative basis, percentage basis offset, or it may result in barring the claim. So, the categorization scheme that the courts talk about is there, but then what? Then something else happens where you have to figure out what you're going to do about it. So what I'm trying to get to is the what are you going to do about it? And as I say, if it fits into Category 1, then it's going to bar the claim. Because there is no negligence if the defendant has simply delivered the unscreened baseball seat that the plaintiff wanted. If it's Category 2, and what you're really saying is that the plaintiff was stupid, then you've got contributory negligence. If it's Category 3, we don't know what the courts are going to do. The best thing would be something like Kirk versus Washington State, where it's an allocation between these different forms of fault. Questions remaining about that? Well, let's move on to, we're not really done with Chapter 5 in the sense that the whole business about contributory negligence and comparative fault, we've been dealing in a sort of one-on-one, plaintiff versus defendant. As we move to Chapter 6, we're now getting sort of more members of the orchestra picking up their instruments and beginning to play. And obviously we now have some very significant complications and some basic policy issues to address. And part of what makes Chapter 6 difficult is that it's complicated. You have to sort of figure out what exactly is going on. But the other thing that makes Chapter 6 difficult is that we're on the horns of a dilemma in which essentially somebody's going to get the short straw in this activity. We're typically looking at a case where we can't make it come out right, and we're making choices about who gets stuck with the bill, in effect. And let me just sketch these two basic problems. The first kind of problem is, what happens if one of the defendants can't pay? Let me see if I can move this without... The classic scenario here is you have a plaintiff's case against two defendants. You've got a drunk driver rear-ending the plaintiff in a Pinto. The manufacturer is one defendant. The driver is another defendant. Plaintiff's injuries are horrific. Millions of dollars in damages. Driver can't pay the share that you would assign to that driver. So what do we do about the claim against the manufacturer? So this is essentially the problem I would call insolvency, or, you know, relative insolvency. The defendant can pay some, but not the defendant's fair share. We essentially have two choices. Either we make the plaintiff get the short straw here, or I guess it's, vaguely remember this, that you pick straws. I think it's the guy with the short straw who wins. It's the guy who doesn't get the short straw who loses. But anyway, however that analogy goes, we stick the plaintiff with the problem of insolvency. We say, well, I'm so sorry that you can only recover the manufacturer's fair share. And let's say the jury gets done with this and says the manufacturer is 30% liable and the driver is 70% responsible because he was drunk and rear-ended the plaintiff. Yes, it's true, the car then burst into flames. There's some defect in the equipment, but 70% of this is due to the negligence of the defendant, of the driver. Okay, do we say the plaintiff only recovers 30% of their damages, because after all it wouldn't be fair to make the manufacturer pay more than their fair share? That's one solution to that problem, but it obviously does an injustice to the plaintiff. On the other hand, we could say, well, sure, if we were allocating as between these two defendants, we'd only make this defendant pay their fair share, but since we're not dealing from a full deck here, we're going to make the manufacturer pay everything. Plaintiff would be very happy with that, but the manufacturer would say, how come I'm having to pay just because I happen to be a deep pocket? And again, we begin to touch this nerve of sort of tort reform. One of the continuing complaints of people who campaign for tort reform is that the people who wind up getting shouldered with the liability are the people that happen to have, you know, the deep pockets. The people who really caused this injury, the drunk drivers, the uninsured, unlicensed, etc., those people we sort of ignore. And now it's the deep pockets who are made to pay for everything just because they happen to have the money. On the other hand, the plaintiff understandably says, if you caused my injury, it's not my fault that someone else helped you cause this injury. As between you and them, fine, go after them to your heart's content, but the plaintiff asks for justice as between them to say, I'm not at fault, you are. If somebody's got to lose in this situation, better you than me. So, as I say, it's not as though we have an obvious, fair solution here. We're making the best of a bad situation. And this is where legislatures come in, and legislatures make what they believe is the best of a bad situation. And legislatures tend to do what they are accustomed to doing, which is compromise. Instead of saying the plaintiff always wins or the defendant always wins, the legislature is inclined to say, well, sometime we're going to put the loss on the plaintiff, sometimes we're going to put the loss on the defendant. It all depends. We want to know some things. We want to know how much was the plaintiff at fault in this case. That certainly has a bearing on it. We want to know whether we're talking about economic damages, where we think the plaintiff really needs a recovery, as distinguished from non-economic damages, where, well, you know, that's sort of funny money. Be nice if you can get it, but it's not really necessary to make the plaintiff whole. It depends on whether the defendant is substantially at fault or only a bit player in this drama. So, again, the legislature, in picking its poison, will choose, oftentimes, to split the difference somehow. And your job on the exam is to try to figure out, to the extent it's an issue for your client, what choices has the legislature made in my jurisdiction? So, again, in terms of the assignment on the exam, it is, first of all, to figure out, do I care? Is my client the plaintiff with multiple defendants, where some are solvent and some aren't, where I need to know what happens if one of them can't pay their fair share of the damages? Am I a deep pocket defendant who could get saddled with the liability for some ne'er-do-well who's my co-defendant because the rules of this jurisdiction are going to make me pay? If I care about it, then I've got to go look at the statutes and find out, okay, what is the deal here? That's problem number one. So the first problem is situations in which multiple defendants, some are solvent, some are not. Second problem, a little more difficult to get at, but it's one that I think is perhaps more significant, or at least is as significant, and that is, what do you do if one of the parties settles? And the reason this is so important is because the vast majority of cases don't end in a jury trial and an award of damages. The vast majority of cases settle. So, depending on what our rules are for settlement, we can that's going to have a huge effect upon the people that don't settle. And again, the typical scenario is one in which the plaintiff has a claim against two defendants, and one of them comes to the defendants comes to the plaintiff and says, I'm prepared to pony up some money to get out of this case. Is this enough money for you to give me a release, to release me? And I'll give you the typical kind of scenario. Actually, this when I first was working in Spokane, this is a case we had. Plaintiff is a 15-year-old kid playing hockey in Riverfront Park. It's junior hockey, you know, where the, whatever, junior hockey. Okay. So he's, as you know, hockey consists of, you know, partially trying to make the puck go someplace, but mostly about whacking people, okay? So in part of this game, he's being knocked into the boards, as they call it. Now, it turns out, as you may know, Riverfront Park, you may have been down there where the hockey rink is in the wintertime. In the summertime, it's full of carnival rides and miniature golf and stuff like that. But in the wintertime, they turn it into an ice rink, and they would put up the plastic shields that protect the hockey puck from going into the stands if it's hit over the wooden railing or wooden fence that surrounds the hockey rink. Well, so whoever was putting up these plastic shields left some part of it, put it in backwards. I don't know exactly how this happened, but there was a little metal piece that protruded from the plastic shield. And as the plaintiff gets knocked into the boards, he happens to strike this little metal piece.
Oh.
You're bracing yourselves. Right below the temple, or right in the temple, just, you know, parallel to the ear. And it's a serious enough blow that it causes him brain damage. He has mild brain damage. Just, you know, he's still functional, but, you know, it's just, he's just not all there anymore. Very haunting case, by the way. But, okay, so there are two defendants in this case. One is the city of Spokane operating this hockey rink. The other is the helmet manufacturer. And the allegation against the helmet manufacturer, which we'll pick up in Chapter 9, on product liability, is that this hockey helmet had a defect in it. It didn't provide protection for this vulnerable area of the head. And if it were properly designed, it would have covered that area and provided him with protection. Now, as this case is being prepared, going through the pretrial process, the city comes to the plaintiff and says, "We're willing to write you a check for $150,000 if you'll dismiss us from this lawsuit." Plaintiff thinks it over, consults with counsel, and the plaintiff says, "Okay, we'll do it. We'll take your $150,000 and release you. However, we're going to continue our case against the helmet manufacturer. We've got a tough road to hoe to persuade a jury that a hockey helmet that doesn't protect that area of the head is defective, but we'll take our chances." Let us suppose that they eventually get to that point where the jury does find that the helmet is defective and they award, as they did, $3.2 million in damages. How much does the helmet manufacturer owe the plaintiff?
So, does this depend on what percent of the negligence?
You could do it that way. That's one alternative. You could say they owe $3.2 million minus whatever share of liability is allocated by the jury to the city. So that in the course of deciding this case, it would be, do you find the helmet manufacturer produced a defective product? If so, please provide, if you also find that the city, that the city's negligence caused this injury, if so, please express in percentage terms to totaling 100%, the relative percentage of fault of each of these two entities. Remember, the city's no longer a defendant. They don't appear. Their employees may appear. The helmet manufacturer may want to talk a lot about this, but they're not. They don't have a lawyer at the trial. They're essentially out of it. So the jury makes an allocation, and let's just say for discussion purposes, they say the city is 60% liable and the helmet manufacturer is 40% liable. The helmet manufacturer then pays 40% of $3.2 million, $1.2 million, something like that. Somewhere in that. Good man. There's an alternative to that. Ms. Shoemaker?
Okay.
This is another alternative that you take 0.150 million, subtract that from, say, good news, helmet manufacturer, you don't owe $3.2 million. You only owe $3.05 million. Now, who's going to be happy with which of these two methods? The plaintiff's obviously going to be happy with the latter most of the time, and the defendant's going to be happy with the former most of the time. And as you'll see when we get to the end of the chapter and we look at the Washburn case, it could actually turn out that on some occasions the defendant would prefer the dollar method and the plaintiff would prefer the percentage method, but most of the time it works the other way for reasons we will talk about. But again, we have a choice to be made. In general, plaintiffs would prefer a system in which they know what they're getting into. If we followed the method Mr. Stubbs described of a percentage reduction, if the plaintiff is offered $150,000, the plaintiff doesn't know what they're giving up. The expression of buying a pig in a poke being a pocket, the older word, so that you had sort of a little, you know, thing that you carried your little piglet around in. So the expression is, you know, in effect, you're buying this hidden thing. I don't really know whether this is a healthy piglet or an unhealthy piglet. The plaintiff's not buying, the plaintiff's selling, but the plaintiff doesn't know what they're committing in exchange for this $150,000 that they're getting. They'd like to know that. So the dollar method is preferable in part because I know what I'm getting into rather than saying I'm giving up this thing, the value of which I can only speculate. Moreover, once I give it up, once the plaintiff gives this up, the party who up till now has been vigorously defending their innocence and trying to persuade everybody we're really not so bad, that defendant no longer has any financial incentive to make themselves look good. The city manager can show up at the trial and say, yeah, we put those things up, I don't know. Somebody get hurt, yes. They can look as bad as they want, it's no skin off their nose. Whereas as long as I have these two as defendants in the case, battling each other, the expression is I can put the two cats in the bag, shake the bag up, let them claw each other. The city will blame the helmet manufacturer. The helmet manufacturer will blame the city. I can, as the plaintiff, stand back and watch the fun. Once I take the city out and it's just me against the helmet manufacturer, I'm really defending the city. I've got to show why it's not the city's fault, it's really the helmet manufacturer's fault. So plaintiffs far prefer a dollar method, but defendants understandably say it isn't fair. And I would say the modern tendency is toward a percentage reduction rather than using the dollar method, but the dollar method was the one first adopted as comparative fault systems came online. Now, Ms. Shoemaker, you said that there's actually a third choice. What's the third? If we don't do a dollar method and we don't do a percentage method, what's our third alternative? Okay. How does that work?
There's two defendants and one settles.
Okay, this again is another sort of compromise. It's sort of like you and I go out to lunch, or the three of us go out to lunch together, and, you know, one orders a cheeseburger and a Diet Coke, and somebody else has the tuna fish sandwich and, a you know, an iced tea, and somebody gets some fries, and, you know, instead of saying, well, gee, this is $4.99 plus 18 plus a, you say, hey, look, here, the bill's $16, there are three of us, let's see what the tip is. It's about, let's just put $7. No, that's too much. we're students after all. Okay, yeah, let's, well, this is about, just split it evenly. Not worry about the details. So, again, one sort of arbitrary way to say it is, rather than nickel and diming this thing, we'll just say, if there are two defendants, we're going to call each share 50%. It's not as precise as being able to say, well, the helmet's 60% or 40%, the city's 60%, but it'll get the job done. It allows us to settle these things in the same way that you go out and get the bill paid, where, yeah, there may be some differences, but let's not sweat that. Again, the legislature chooses among these different systems depending upon what strikes their fancy as being the best way to go. Now, I'm going to put a little less emphasis upon the settlement aspects of this because, quite frankly, it's kind of hard to test it. Most of my exam questions are in the form of essentially the client walks in shortly after after the accident's taken place or after some investigation, but long before a complaint is filed or whatever. And I say, in essence, you know, evaluate this, assess the strengths and weaknesses of this case. So it's hard at that point to say, okay, and what would you do if the case settled? That sort of comes at a different, you know, time sequence. From time to time, I have put it in that form. I've said, okay, here's the deal. These things have happened. Here's the evidence. This party's fanning $100 bills in front of the plaintiff's nose, and you represent the plaintiff. You grab the bills and run for the door, or do you say, no thanks, I'll see you at trial? Again, the pressures, as we talked about before, the pressures on the plaintiff, where there may be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow 2 or 3 years hence when this case goes to trial, when the appeals are finally exhausted. Finally, there will be money, but in the meantime, I got to eat, I got to get, you know, my rent paid, etc. So a plaintiff has a strong incentive to put some money in the bank from a defendant who's willing to cough up some money in settlement, but that has to be offset by the question, what am I giving up? Is it worth it to me to take the money now and suffer the consequences later? I need to know what those consequences are. And I must say, I've had more than one phone call from a lawyer inquiring about, well, now, is it really true that I can't go after this other deep pocket for everything they're worth just because I took the limits of this defendant's insurance policy? I had a guy who called me. He said, you know, my client was injured in this accident late at night. The driver, or the person who was driving, paid the limits of their policy. Now it turns out I got a case against the county. My client wasn't at fault. Under Washington law, they're entitled to a full recovery if they're not at fault, but now the county's claiming that because they settled with this other guy, that share of the lawsuit is gone and there's no more joint and several liability. Yep, that's the deal. You mean if I hadn't settled with it, I could get a full recovery, but since I settled with them, I can't? Yep, that's the deal. So, again, it's sort of surprising as you think, what's the difference between this and that? Sometimes there's a very significant difference because, again, the legislature has made a choice about the way they want these kind of priorities to be resolved. Okay, with that sort of general overview, Mr. Gallagher.
Well, under the example you just gave, what do you consider to be a full settlement?
Well, the notion would be if I can prove to a jury that my damages are $3.2 million, if, for example, in the case I just mentioned, the parties here are the county and the negligent driver. The negligent driver paid $20,000, the limits of their minimal auto policy. The jury decides the plaintiff's damages are $2 million, but they also decide that the county's negligence in not properly placing this stop sign, you know, and having it at the wrong angle so that the driver couldn't see it until it was too late to stop, and that's what caused the collision. Relative to the driver, you know, and all the other problems of the driver, speeding and not paying attention and so forth, they say the driver is 60% at fault and the county's only 40% at fault. I'm only going to get $800,000, whereas if I had said to the driver, thanks for the offer, $20,000 would really help, but I don't want to get $20,000 now, when I could get $1.2 million out of the county later, but only if I resist your offer of settlement. So the way the joint and several liability rules work for insolvency is different from the way the rules work with respect to settlement. Now, and one of the things I want to sort of point to as a general thing, we read the California case Lee versus Yellow Cab, and you'll recall the court said, gee, we're not ready yet to decide these questions about multiple tortfeasors. We want to wait until we have a properly litigated case with parties in front of us who can argue these very points. Well, 3 years later, they do get such a case, American Motorcycle, and you'll notice that Justice Clark is complaining in that case. We started talking about making liability follow fault. That was supposed to be our, you know, the golden thread running through this whole body of law. And what are we doing? We're sticking the deep pocket defendants with the lion's share of the liability and not giving them a fair opportunity to limit their liability to their share of fault. Liability is not following fault. It's follow the money. And I think you could have a lot of sympathy with Justice Clark's complaint. On the other hand, the question is, well, who is going to pay for it then? Is it fair to tell the plaintiff, I'm sorry, you're limited to what the county is assigned as a share of fault because this other defendant can't pay their fair share and that's you're going to get stuck with it? So, again, these are difficult questions. Don't be surprised, I guess I'm trying to say, don't be surprised that the law seems to sort of go at right angles. It doesn't make these nice, smooth, you know, transitions. It abruptly says, well, up to this point you were okay, but now we're pushing you over the cliff. Because there may be something else going on that they have in their mind. Okay, now what I want to do is kind of very quickly go through these actual statutes that we have at the beginning of Chapter 6 and just, you know, learn to navigate your way through it, figure out of the choices that are presented to the legislature, where did they come out? So let's start with this Idaho statute, our neighbor to the east. The first question is, what form of a rule with respect to contributory negligence has Idaho chosen to follow? Ms. Reed. Pardon? And of the two major varieties, what are the two major varieties? In a larger sense, when in Lee versus Yellow Cab, and the court said, we want comparative fault, but what form? The two major forms are pure and modified. Okay, you're at a second fork in the road here. The first fork in the road is, has Idaho chosen, as California thought you should, have they chosen a pure comparative fault? No, they've chosen a form of modified comparative fault, which is we're okay with the plaintiff being at fault, but only to a point. Once you get to this point, it's not a gradual decrease. We push you over the cliff. And what point is that? Who's less than 50? Okay, in other words, the point at which we push you over the cliff is when your negligence is as great as the defendant's. So 50-50 goes to the defendant. And while in theory there's no huge difference, there's a very, very small difference between 49.9999% and 50%, the scary thing about this kind of rule is, even as a plaintiff, if you're confident that if they find me at fault, surely they're going to find the defendant more at fault than I am. If the jury says, we can't really tell the difference, they're both at fault, by how much? Let's call 50-50. That means I lose. I get nothing. As distinguished from a pure system, which says no matter how much at fault you are, it only reduces, it doesn't bar your claim. And as distinguished from the 50% variety, which says the jury actually has to find the plaintiff more at fault than the defendant before the plaintiff's claim gets barred. It depends on the way the jury instructions are written. Sometimes it will say, in effect, for example, in the jury instructions, do you find the defendant negligent? If you answer no to this question, sign at the bottom and return. It's pretty clear that's the end of the ball game for the plaintiff. So it may be that they say, in effect, if you find this more than, sign your verdict form and return it, but if you find this thing, then continue on with the other questions that we ask you. So the jury either figures this out or, it's not a big, deep, dark secret. By contrast, what is a deep, dark secret to the jury? For example, going back to my hockey helmet case, what happened to the city is a mystery to the jury. They walk into the courtroom, they get selected for jury duty, they hear about this case, about how the accident happened, they see the lawyer for the plaintiff, they see the lawyer for the defendant. Why isn't city here? Why isn't there a lawyer for the city? Why aren't they? What's going on here? And they can begin to speculate. Many jurors who have some experience or whatever say, I bet they settled. But they don't know that, and they don't know on what terms. So that part of it is stuff they cannot figure out by themselves, but many times jurors looking at these things will get a sense, if we do this, it has this consequence. Okay, so the first thing is in terms of contributory negligence rule, it is this modified form, and it's only it's the 49% variety. The plaintiff can't be more than 49% liable or they lose altogether. What about joint several liability? Here the plaintiff's injured by more than one defendant. The defendants are found different percentages of fault. Does the plaintiff get a full recovery? And that's tough luck for the defendants. Does it depend on whether the plaintiff is at fault? Is it divided up into economic damages or non-economic damages? What's the deal? Ms. Brady.
I think it's divided
Okay. But under what circumstances can the plaintiff say, well, I need a full recovery. I wasn't, it was my fault that these defendants collectively injured me. Are there any circumstances in which the plaintiff can get a full recovery even though some defendant is only partially at fault?
Peters?
What's that? Yeah, if two defendants are acting in concert, so, you know, they all decide they're going to have a drag race or they all decide they're going to do something that's negligent. Any other circumstances? Yeah, for hazardous or toxic wastes. So if you run a hazardous waste site and or you contribute to a hazardous waste site, you're the dry cleaning establishment that put the organic solvents in the landfill and that's what poisoned the plaintiff's water and made him sick, you can't say, well, I only put in 3% of the chemicals. You're jointly and severally liable for that. But notice that there are a limited set of circumstances. It also says any cause of action arising from the manufacture of a medical device or pharmaceutical product. So people who make pharmaceutical products are jointly and severally liable for damages. So like in the DES cases, if you decide that Park Davis is responsible even only for part of the liability under a market share theory, they pay on the basis of joint several liability. The plaintiff's entitled to a full recovery. But with respect to the hockey helmet manufacturer, Ford Motor Company, or your garden variety defendants, outside of these narrow exceptions, it's basically defendant's paradise. Defendants only have to pay the share assigned to them by the jury. If they can convince the jury that other people are responsible for the plaintiff's harm, they can confine their liability down to a smaller percentage. And again, this is, you know, defendants like this, and plaintiffs hate it. Because a plaintiff could be injured in Idaho by a negligent driver who doesn't have nearly enough insurance, or maybe uninsured altogether, unlicensed, etc. License suspended. They're still out on the road. They caused the injury. And, oh, by the way, it's also caused by some poor road maintenance or some other kind of problem, but that defendant will only have to pay whatever share they can convince the jury should be theirs. So as you look at the Idaho statute, this is great for the defendants and bad news for the plaintiff with respect to comparative fault issues. Finally, what about settlement? This is the most difficult of all the settlement provisions here. The way you find it, first of all, and learning how to read these statutes is essentially learning how to find which headings apply to what. You know, I'm looking for something that has to do with settlement here. And what I'm looking for is this language that says effect of release of one tortfeasor. Because remember, the coin of the realm here is defendant gives money in exchange for a release. You sign a document that says, in exchange for this money, I hereby release my claim. So typically the statutory language you're looking for is what's the effect of that settlement or of that release? And after you get all done with this, this says in effect, well, it doesn't reduce the claim for contribution unless the plaintiff agrees in the course of this settlement to give up a pro rata in this language, it means an equal share of the liability. So it in effect says, hey, plaintiff and defendant, you can do anything you want, but it's not going to help you when this other defendant comes calling unless you agree to give up a pro rata share, an equal share. So again, if you didn't know what you were looking for, I don't think you'd figure this one out. But I'm not quite as cruel as this. When I put together the statute on the exam, I make it a little more user-friendly so that it's something you've either seen before, or something which with reasonable examination you can figure it out. From here on in, it gets more straightforward, but we'll pick up with the Oregon statute after we take our morning break here.